The regular and supplemental meetings are called to order. We're going to go ahead and recess the supplemental meeting. The first thing I'd like to have is a moment of silence for those that are not with us anymore. Thank you. Next, we'll go to the meeting, the minutes of the February 8th meeting. Do we have any comments or questions on those? And if not, can I have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Any
opposed? The motion carries. Next, we'll go to item G, public comment. Would anyone like to say anything, either to your president or on the phone?
Press 5-star on the phone.
5-star on the phone.
Okay. Next, Kelly and Josh, the independent actuarial analysis and recommendations and section 2.025 update.
Okay. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
John, do I have the remote?
I don't see it over here.
I might have buried it. Okay, I found it. All right. So I have a short presentation here.
I'm interested.
Okay, thank you. If you can go to the next page. And what I wanted to talk about a little bit is just to review the Chiron recommendations, which you heard in November from their preliminary report and then their final report based on the 1/1/23 valuation they presented at our last meeting in February. Then have a discussion about your thoughts and if there's anything in the Chiron report that you don't like, need additional information for, that type of thing. I'll share with you City of Dallas comments and statements that they've made in public that I can share at this time, and then talk about where we go from here. And that's kind of the idea for today. John, can you go to the next page? Okay, so Chiron's report, as you recall, and I actually, you should have a hard copy of the report at your place there. I didn't want to repeat all of the slides and pages. It's a long report, so I made sure that you all had a copy so you can look through it. They primarily had three main recommendations. The first one was to adopt an actually determined contribution rate instead of a fixed rate. We call that the ABC. That's a calculation, that's a math calculation that's done every year to say, to fund this plan in 30 years, what would the contribution need to be? Again, it's not a fixed rate. We currently have a fixed rate. The ABC ensures that we're always in compliance with the pension review board guidelines. And under Texas law, with the FSRP rules that are now in place, every municipal plan will eventually have an ABC. If they're currently over 30 years fund, they'll have one as soon as they adopt their next FSRP, but eventually everybody will get there. So doing the ABC is really nothing unusual. We would all get there. The observations and recommendations and rationale for the recommendation for Chiron are on page 18 of the materials that Chiron provided. On 17, it really shows the comparison of these different approaches to the ABC, if you wanted to take a look at that. But Chiron on page actually 11, they talked about different ways to structure the ABC. So the decisions around the ABC are not really whether to have one or not, but basically required to have one. It's really the structural issues of how do you structure how that unfunded liability is paid off. And they have recommended five different scenarios, including, you know, just go immediately to it or phase it in and then phase it down. And there's a series of recommendations on page 11. They talk about their preferred options, their least preferred options. So there's structural considerations. There's also implementation issues. I wouldn't worry too much about that. That is more about the timing on when we get our valuation and when those contribution amounts kick in, whether it's, we get the valuation in January and it's effective the next fiscal year for the city, because their fiscal year starts October 1st, or if there's another year lag. So that I'm not overly worried about. So that's kind of the ADC issues. And we can go over more of these as we talk about this. The next recommendation that they had is really kind of a minor change from where we are in the plan. They're recommending that we reduce the employee contribution rate as the funding improves. This is a change that, based on getting the ADC and meeting all the assumptions in the plan, wouldn't have any impact at all until 2041. What they're saying is once we become 50% funded, they would start phasing down the 13.5% that the employees currently pay until it gets down to 50% of the ADC. And the current plan, as written, says when the plan is 100% funded, there's no longer an unfunded liability. The members would pay 50% of the ADC. So it's really just getting it there between once we're 50% funded to 90% funded is the way it happens. So that's a change from 2041 to basically 2055. That increases the ABC amount by an average of 2.3%. So it is cost, but it's cost way out there, and it starts at a 0.5% increase and goes up to 4, but an average of 2.3%. So that's what that change is. And then the last one talks about having some sort of a COLA earlier in the process. So just to remind you, in the current statute, we have a COLA. We always talk like we don't because it's so far out there. Without the ADC, it's currently projected to come in 2073. The ADC will get us 70% funded quicker. So with no change and meeting all the assumptions, it would kick in 2046, which is a very long time from now. The structure of the current COLA is you take the average five-year return, which right now we're assuming would be 6.5%. You subtract 5% from that, and then the COLA is the difference. So the model is in the 1.5% COLA. That's if all assumptions are met once you get to 70%. There's also other provisions in there. You can't get the COLA until you're the earlier of you've been retired for 3 years or you're age 62. And you have to have, obviously, our average return has to be about 5, where there would be no positive number to share in the COLA. Any questions about the current COLA? Page 28 to page 38 of the Chiron presentation, the February presentation, includes 7 different COLA options. There's other options that could be considered, but they just put these 7 out there for consideration at this time. Some of them are just minor changes from the COLA that we have now to others that consider like purchasing power, those types of things. Page 37 of the presentation talks about a summary of the impacts of the various COLAs. So that's basically the provisions. And I can go through these more after we kind of talk a little bit about this. So would you like to, where would you like to go from here? Would you like me to talk about the various ADC structural options?
I think the process would be probably the next best thing to talk about.
Okay.
Because I think when people have a good understanding of what the process likely will be, then you can kind of frame your mind around what are the various options. Would you all agree with that? Yeah, okay.
So where we are at this point is I have been having meetings and conversations with the city CFO, and we are trying to decide or come up with, you know, what is it the city might be amenable to, what do they like, what do they don't like. And I haven't had a conversation with the board to know really where you are. I, as a staff member, have some ideas on what I would recommend, but want to know where they are. So I can talk a little bit about where I think the city is a little regardless of where the city is, the process that we have going forward is the board has to adopt a plan because of our section 2.025. And we are hopeful and work really hard to make sure to try to get that plan to be something that the city likes as well. So we adopt a plan, the city could adopt a similar plan if they choose to, they could do whatever they need to do on the city side. But even if we don't agree, if we want one ABC structure, we want a COLA or a different COLA than they want, the board can do that. But we would adopt that plan. That plan basically becomes the law and would be what's in place until that gets changed. And the way that would get changed, if it does, is through legislative action in 2025. So that's really the process. The timeline that we've been working towards.
But Kelly, just to add a little color to that, probably the only reason it would be kicked to the state in 2025 would be if we in the city do not agree. And our view is that we need to adopt a plan, and that plan becomes codified. Josh, is it fair to say the city doesn't necessarily see it that way, or as we get more granular, they don't necessarily see it that way? And so that's kind of where it is right now.
So let me mention this. To the extent that we adopt a plan, does that bind? I assume that the city may have different views on it, but adopting a plan does not mean that it institutes a financial obligation on the part of the city to fund it as such.
It does until the legislature changes that. That's our opinion.
Okay. And what's their opinion?
Their opinion is that they have the right, that a plan has to be approved by both, or the same plan, I should say, has to be approved by both the city and the board.
Okay. All right. So it really doesn't change the fact that we need to adopt something.
Right.
At the end of the day, whatever happens, that first move is to adopt something.
Correct.
But I think every step along the way, it serves everyone's interests to find common ground with the city. It's not the optimal plan to have a codified, we adopt something and they either adopt something else or adopt nothing and we're at an impasse. That is not the best scenario. Maybe a agreeable or who knows whether that's a good scenario, but it's not the best scenario. The best scenario is that we agree with them on something that we all feel like really serves the interests of the plan going forward well and adheres to the PRB guidelines of shortening the time to fund the liability.
But the first move is for us to do this. That's the first move. I guess what I'm trying to say is, yeah, of course we're going to try to get the middle ground with them, but the first move on behalf of the pension fund system is to adopt a plan. And from there, they will come back to us. Are we going to?
I think let Kelly continue with what's going on. There's some process and timeline information that would be spot on to what you're talking about.
So the city would really like to have a plan adopted before they do their budget, and I would really like that too. The sooner we know what's going on, everybody will feel better. So the original timeline that we have been talking about, the city and me, has been, we would have a conversation today, just kind of initial thoughts from our board. In April, we would come back, have deeper thoughts, if there's more information that you want Chiron to run, anything like that. So we have a conversation in May, and if you're ready, we would adopt something in May. Then the city would have, they're kind of starting now, but basically by June, they would have it ready for their budget process. I believe they might want to accelerate that now to having the pension committee maybe adopt something on April 11th. which would be problematic because I'm not sure our board would be ready to do that. But the city can adopt a plan. I mean, they can adopt their plan. It doesn't mean we have to adopt the same one. So we'll just have to see how that plays out if they really are ready to do something in April and where the board is.
So if I understand it correctly, so we'll obviously be in constant communication with them. We'll get some type of indication of at least where the board is informally at in terms of, you know, where we're headed. But I guess what I'm trying to understand is when we adopt the plan, it will be either something that is consistent with what the city is that we want, or be in the ballpark, or at the end of the day, we'll have two competing plans. Possibly.
It could be the end of the plan. I mean, we would love to have the same plan.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah. We'll see. We're working towards that. I don't know if we'll get there.
Kelly, would it be fair to say that we believe the plan we adopt will be the plan that adheres to the already existing law, and by factors we might not control, the state legislature may change the law?
But that's out of our hands.
Yeah. And a catalyst for that could be the city voicing disagreement with what we enact.
And they may want to go outside of the Chiron recommendations. I mean, what they have said publicly, the Chiron recommendations are pretty straightforward, right? They have three recommendations. They don't seem that hard to me. But then when you look at where the city is, what they've said publicly in the staff presentation and in other meetings, I mean, they're talking about, I don't have this on slide, but this was information from their January presentation to their pension committee. The staff is currently recommending, and I think this is still where they are, that we increase the city contributions to a set dollar amount for a phase-in period. Well, that's a fixed dollar amount. That's not an ADC. We've had conversations of a fixed dollar amount and a percentage of an ADC are very different things. I would support a phase-up of a percentage of the ADC. I wouldn't support a fixed dollar amount. So they seem similar, and the dollar amounts might be the same, but they don't act the same in trying to get fully funded. They also don't want to phase down at the end of the period. John, can you go to page 11 of the Chiron?
The city also selected Chiron. Do you write
it? No, the PRB selected Chiron. So they're independent, and we're not directing Chiron. We have the contract with them for somebody to use.
And so does the city have an independent?
The city has always had since 2016, they've had their own actuary, Deloitte, and Deloitte is advising them for running things at the city's request type of thing.
And do we know what that kind of information that the city is getting from Deloitte?
In their ad hoc meeting, the last one, Chiron presented. So, I mean, maybe they are getting advice, but in terms of what is on in front of people or pondering, deliberating, it's this report. Yeah.
Right. But they might be talking to Deloitte on what are the things we can do to lower the amount that goes in. They might be giving advice. I don't know what those conversations are.
But they're not necessarily disputing accuracy of the information that's presented by Chiron or the number is zero.
They have not disputed anything publicly. So Chiron put the structural options in related to the phase up, phase down of the structure of the ABC. And it was traditional, which is basically I amortized it evenly over the 30-year period to phase in over a 3 or 5 year period for budget reasons. And then we're going to phase down over the 3 or 5 year period. There, Chiron was recommending the phase down because they say their clients typically want that. When all of a sudden, you know, they're paying hundreds of millions of dollars in contributions and then they drop off one day, they say that's cost budget issues for people. But they also, because the Jack actually requested this when I was final and putting it in there, they did a 3-year phase up and a 5-year phase up without the phase down. So Tyron put these in the presentation of their most preferred as being the traditional and their least preferred, the 5-year step up with no step down. According to the public presentation, the staff recommendation is that least preferred option. If you go to slide, if you go to 17 for me, John. You know, one of the things I learned from page 17 here is on the box in the top left is it doesn't make that big of a difference in your fees from our standpoint. So, you know, we're the, under the traditional, the lowest the funding level drops to is 34%, I mean 32%, and the best will be 34% where we are right now. The funding year is either 2046 or 2047. So from the funding standpoint of the plan, and when we reach 70%, I think from our standpoint, they're all about the same. The bottom chart shows you the impact, which is dramatic, having the ABC on reducing our negative cash outflow. And you can see on all of them, you know, they make a pretty big difference pretty quickly. Obviously, the traditional makes the biggest impact soonest, but by 2029, we've gone from what this shows is a 7% negative cash outflow to less than 2 or around 2%. That's huge. That's just a dramatic change. So I think from our standpoint, these are all pretty neutral. If I was advising the city, not my job, but, you know, all of these phase up, phase down, what that's doing is it's squeezing the balloon, which is making their ABC for those middle years be much higher. I'm not sure if I was a CFO, I would want my middle years to be much higher, but that's not my job, that's for them to decide. And that's really what's shown in the right side of this chart. The top section shows what their contributions would be in 2025, and that takes the phase in. But then the bottom part shows 2029, that's after all the phase in, phase down. And you can see the contributions are much higher because of those phase in, phase down, than they would be if they just did the traditional. But that's a city issue. So the phase up with no step down basically had cost the city another $8 million in 2029, and then every year after that because of delaying that. That's a city budget decision. So that's kind of the issue with this piece.
So what I think would be great is just some sense of what are our priorities. And, you know, if we can kind of get a sense of the priorities today, then maybe next meeting we could have a staff recommendation on the more specifics, but guided by what we say are the priorities. Just to kind of throw something out there, what I see, first principles, the most important thing is the ABC. The concept is, I don't think, being debated, but I would want to see more sooner. You know, if you have a 5-year or even a 3-year phase in, I mean, that's, you know, that's not as many dollars today. And since we are running negative cash flow today, ABC more now, not a long phase in or any phase in would be, to me, priority one. Priority two would be a COLA of something that is more real, both in terms of reality and perception, sooner rather than later. And then the third would be the decreased contributions, which would be down the road anyway. So that's my sense of it based upon what I've heard. I'd love to hear what you all think. And like I said, it'd be great to get some sort of consensus that then we could task Kelly to come back next month with a staff recommendation that then we would debate and
adjusted or whatever. My first principle is that we have a billion plus hole in the program, and the fiduciary obligation is to make sure that the fund is as healthy as possible. So I'm in favor of the so first is fund health, and obviously we need an infusion of lots of funds for it to be healthy. With that principle being in mind, the greatest infusion of cash or funds is probably my first principle. So less of a ramp up is preferable to me. And I guess the second thing is we represent police officers and firemen, and I want to make sure that they're as competitive as possible. I'm in favor of the COLA, and I think that at least gives some form of opportunity to be competitive in this market to make sure that our police environment are at least being able to, you know, we can get good candidates in there, you know, competitive in the market, even though obviously 1.5% is not a whole lot whenever that were to come. So those are my views. Financial health, more money as soon as possible is preferable to waiting. The COLA to me is somewhat of a probably a distant second, because nothing really works until we're able to get financially healthy. And right now we're not.
Yeah, I like the idea of more sooner. Given the present value of the money, COLA gets more complex because I, having been on the other side and seeing the bias toward not providing a COLA until a fund is actually sound, is more a convention of reality than what we'd like to see. But I think a COLA is very important. If there's a way that we can negotiate that in, even as a partial or a 13th check approach. I presume the sale leaseback idea is no go.
Well, I think that that's all out there, but turning it into something actionable for today is not something I think we can count on. I mean, I've thought about, we are at an impasse. Do you start talking about, conditional transfer, all those assets that could be monetized? Is there something there that can help bridge a difference? I thought about that, but that's not, I think, kind of the immediate discussion, but maybe the way to solve the impasse to go downward. But I'm thinking about that in the back of my mind.
That's really more of a funding issue, not a gift of money.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really, it's how the city's going to pay off the ABC, right? Because it will really just change the math. So there's no decision that needs to be made about if we get a lump sum payment in, we'll apply it to the ABC. That's just math. Money coming in, it's going to lower the ABC this year or 5 years from now.
Can I ask a question? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so fundamentally, we would all agree that we need more money sooner. I'm just curious to see or to hear, because according to Nick's first principles, I agree with it. ABC, COLA, decrease in contributions. I understand that fundamentally, and I agree with all of that. But for the first ABC, the nuanced question is, are we all in agreement that it's just the immediate adoption of the ABC, and we're really not in favor of a phase in, whether it's 3 or 5 years in, up or down? Or, that's kind of what I think it's more interesting to have a conversation on. Are we all in agreement of an ABC, and is it an immediate adoption where there's not a phase up or down?
I think that we want to expressed a strong preference and engaged in a discussion where hopefully we can find common ground, where at the end of the day, it may not be a day one, you know, immediate step up to the traditional, but maybe it's something pretty close. So, you know, we, and then perhaps as we think about monetizing assets that can be used as a bridge for some of this in some conditional way. So I don't think, you know, my suggestion would be not to say that that's, you know, a line in the sand today, but to indicate that or something real close to that probably is a line in the sand. And that we're not open to some, you know, phase in that, you know, many years.
Okay, that's fair. And then the other thing that I do kind of want to mention is that it's been intimated about the implementation and some of the logistics around it. From conversations we've had before, there seems to be a material delay. And that, I think, is important when we're thinking about the phase in and phase out and what that number is and the delay. Or does that work itself out with the ADC, generally speaking, because of the delay? It gets adjusted every year, so it kind of, in some way, considers that. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like there is, it seems to be a material delay, and when it does get implemented or when that number is calculated.
I think that's very common, Tina, because it allows the city to plan for it and budget for it. So I think looking at if we were able to get our ADC number by January 1, to actually have them put it in the budget and start paying it 10-1, that's actually pretty quick. There are some that might argue that maybe they should start paying on a January 1 basis, give them a year to build it in, or they might want, you know, a year and 10 months. So that, I don't think is that unusual, just because the dollars are big and it's a big part of their budget that they would need to adjust for. But we can still
work. Okay.
And just
one comment, which is actually just more over, like, it says in Chiron's presentation, under current Texas law, every municipal plan will over time be funded on an ADC. I mean, aren't we just doing that?
Yes.
Is that too simplistic to understand? I mean, like, I'm confused a little bit because I still think there's discussions about a fixed number in and out.
I would tell you at least 5 conversations about this, and there seems just to be some confusion of there's a difference between a fixed rate for a period of time and a percentage of the ADC. So we're still working on that concept. You know, I mean, just how it mechanically works, we're struggling a little bit. You know, back to in the staff recommendations, they have the corridor concept, the cap concept. That doesn't work with the ADC. So those are some things I think we just need to work out.
Yeah, Tina, what you're saying is that someone might, we don't want it to be an ADC in name only, but the actual reality of it feels like it's something different. It actually is something different. The ADC is the concept that everyone's going to move to, but like anything else, there's going to be probably some interpretation on what it actually is, you know, jurisdiction.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's why we want to have it be implemented as quickly as possible with either no or the least amount of phase in, and just, you know, adhering to the principles that I've heard everyone say so far, which is more quicker and make this thing more, you know, reduce negative cash flow and reduce or increase the fund percentage and all those things that we want to do. So I think we're gaining some consensus around that, but I will just, you know, recommend we not draw a line in the sand and say it's traditional day one, end of story, that's our only position. I think that we need to have a little bit of flexibility to try to find common ground.
I do have one question on the city's feedback on traditional basically show a more steady state payment through the closer. Is it the dollar amount that is choking them?
Yes.
Because it would be consistent with the budget to have a line item that was pretty close all the way along, but obviously significantly higher than some of
them. Right. It's really that they're really focused completely on the dollar and even at the dollar amount, because the ADC percentage, even on the step up, step down version, once you get through that, it's a consistent percentage all the way through. But it doesn't mean it's a consistent payment because, I mean, you've got the contributions that are going up, the payroll going up, that's pretty consistent. What is kind of making it fluctuate is the benefit payments don't go up at an even amount because they hired a lump of people in this year and, you know, that working its way through the system type of thing.
But in the discussions that they've had with their outside consultants, the mechanisms to fund whatever it is have been presented. And so if the dollars are accepted, even though they're higher, then it's really just a funding question of where do we get those dollars from. Are they resisting the feedback that, you know, Bill's group and we, I mean, there seems to be...
I think it's just very basic that it suggests easier to talk about a larger amount years down the road than it is in the immediate time. I think it's really just as practical as that. And all the stuff that Bill's group did, that you're thinking about, those are all ways that perhaps we can bridge a gap to find common ground. But the core issue is just that, you know, if you have 5 years to get somewhere versus next year, it's just easier to agree to that and to plan around that. It's just that simple.
And in this January staff recommendation presentation, they had a slide on that, and they had a timing slide on selling assets. And their timeline was basically to take a year to hire a consultant. So I think they've got something on there, but it would be nothing immediate.
Yeah,
out of curiosity, do we know what kind of budget increases are expected by the city going forward? Do they have is there a mandated 4%, 3%, 6%? Is there factoring into their budgets?
I don't know what their budget increases are.
Okay. Because that would be something else to incorporate into our numbers as we go forward. The state, each session comes up with a certain... they don't put it in print, but this is the kind of number that we expect to go with over the next several years, and finding that out might help us in terms of good cover.
Yeah, I mean, I would think that just from a strategy standpoint, to be invited in to this is how much we have, we'll never know everything. The most what we'll know is a subset of all the relevant information. So, I would find that's pretty unproductive to try to limit ourselves by what they present us as their limitations. I mean, it's, you know, relevant, but I just think it's a bad way to get to an answer.
I agree. I guess one of the keys is what's negotiable and what's not when you really get down to it.
I think that's what Chris Berman used to say. That's why we play the game.
But Nick, I guess what I'm trying to say for it to be more substantive conversation around the ADC is I'm saying, what about it? Okay, are we in agreement? Do we all think it should be an ADC? And that's just one thing. And the next thing is, how do we feel about the step-ups? I mean, like, otherwise, I mean, the other two conversations can be conversations in and of itself, but what is it about the ADC that you want consensus on?
Tina, I think at least what I'm hearing is that there's a consensus that we want the ADC as soon as the traditional route. We tend to move towards the traditional route as soon as possible, but we probably want to at least give ourselves some room to hear what they have to say, as opposed to coming up with a actually actually don't like negotiating in an open session. I think the principle is that we want to front load as much as we can. I think that's the principle. I don't think we've come up with a red line or a number yet, because we're probably too early in the process of communicating with the other party.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. I get it. I see that.
So, Tina, when you're asking the question, what does the board think about the ADC, are you asking, should we be looking at something outside of the Chiron recommendation, such as I think we have a lump sum coming in first or something like that?
No, I think if we deviate, I think one of the most important things is that we go to an impartial consultant like Chiron that was given to us by the PRB. I think we have to stay on their recommendations. I really truly believe we have to, otherwise it creates more noise. But I think there are viable solutions there. I mean, so I don't think we need to go outside those lines if that's what you were suggesting.
I have one question, and this is for Josh. I mean, we are kind of trying to discuss probably possible negotiations with the city. Is that something we should be doing in open session like this? Or is this something that we probably should do in closed session?
Well, it certainly is something that should be done on a more non-public basis. Unfortunately, there's not, and I don't know what the city does I don't know what the city's going to do when they talk about this as their call on this, but the Open Meetings Act doesn't really give us an exception to generally talk about this type of thing in a closed session. So I think that what Kelly and I had hoped to accomplish through the discussion is to get a sense of where the board is at, which I think we're getting, and then kind of go back and have these more discussion sessions.
So, these are just ideas, right?
Yeah.
We look for the concept, more money sooner, stressful, solvency, getting the fund solvent is a priority.
I would like to hear a little bit more, but quite honestly, I'm not that abreast of the COLA, and I know that it's our members significantly. So I actually want to hear what people think of the COLA, because to me it's somewhat of a distant second priority for me. But I'm open to hear what other people's views are on that.
So can I start with just a little thought I have about the COLA? We've heard a lot of conversation in the pension meetings and even from Chiron about the need for a COLA for recruitment and retention, but nobody's representing the retirees here.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. You don't want someone to come work for you for 30 years and then they don't matter anymore. Nobody wants that. But nobody's speaking for the retirees. So I threw up your slide 37 in that top right box, I think really illustrates why Chiron thinks that we need a COLA, and that top line shows the purchasing power of our current COLA. So if we do nothing and don't change it, if someone were to retire in 2024, they get their hard-earned pension of years of service times the 2.5% or whatever the multiplier is times their age, they get that, and they can buy X amount of stuff with those dollars. By the time they're 80, let's say in 2054, they can only buy 50% of that X amount of stuff. I mean, the purchasing power decline is dramatic with our current COLA. And I think that's the issue for the retirees. So not having a COLA to 2046, a lot of our current retirees will not see a COLA in their remaining lifetime under the current scenario. So that's why Chiron put together these options. They they're not recommending like the Dallas ERS COLA that's just so incredibly expensive that the civilians have. They're not recommending that, but they put that in there for comparison. The least expensive of the two COLA options presented here are the one, the third one down called the immediate partial COLA, and that actually kind of slows down the decay of the purchasing power. Not all the way. I mean, it still goes all the way down to 60%, but it takes longer to get there. And then the other one that's not as expensive is the current COLA plus 70% of purchasing power. And I can talk a little more about those if you wanted more information. But those are just some initial
COLA. One question is, how does our COLA compare to our peer police first responders in the area?
I had that in the January presentation. Do you remember? I didn't bring that up with you. The November presentation. It lags. By far.
And I think, a lot of what the local, we don't have the data from Chiron because a lot of the local plans, not the big ones that are standalone, but the ones that are in TMRS, most of them have a COLA built into the TMRS plan, and that's not Chiron was capturing those. They were capturing the big cities like San Antonio, Houston, Austin, Fort Worth. But like the ones that the city competes more with, the local plans like the satellite cities like the Planos and those types of things, their plans, their people are in TMRS, and they all, I think they, my guess is they virtually all, if not all, have a COLA built in, some amount of a COLA. So TMRS allows you to have a certain, that you can opt into whatever COLA percentage you want.
What's the average level of, look at all the police and fire, what's their average on tenure in terms of when would they be hitting in retirement? I guess I'm trying to have an idea of, obviously, if you're a current retiree, those numbers aren't great, but if you're a typical fire or police and you're 15 years out, what does that look like under the current, under our current situation, or what, that look like?
So,
and you may not have that information, but I'm trying to make sure, I'm trying to understand the COLA a little bit better. Not in terms of someone who's retiring today or who's retired now, but what our typical...
So to max out your benefit now, with the changes in 2017, you have to work until you're age 58. It used to be 50.
But Kelly, wouldn't you say that the majority of our department, both because of what happened in 2017, is really unusually younger than most?
Strange because we used to have people work longer with the average retirement age being around 56 because of drop, they would stay longer. And then once drop changed, and the issues that we had a lot of people leave. So now we kind of have this barbell situation where we do have a lot of younger people, but they're going to have to work longer. So my guess right now, I think the average retirement age is around 56, 57, if that will gradually go up a little.
Okay, I'm sorry, and I don't want to put too much time on that. I just want to understand COLA a little better.
No, I think those are good comments.
I tell you, I have one question about the ERF.
Uh-huh.
Where that fits in terms of discussions with the city, where they are, because obviously the dollars to solve both.
Right, so the situation with ERF, as I understand it, is ERF is treated like a city department, whereas we are treated as a different entity. And the way that you change the ERF plan, and this is all my understanding, might not be 100% accurate, is it takes three changes to change the ERF Chapter 40, which is their plan. The ERF board has to approve it, the city council has to approve it, and has to go to the voters to approve it. Currently, the way that they're funded is the actuary calculates the ABC, and then that is shared two-thirds with the city, one-third was employees, but it's capped at a total of 36%. And they are going to the voters, not in May, it looks like November, maybe next May, to get rid of that cap. But what they're going to do, instead of having the employee contribution rate still be a third, they're capping that. So it'll go up slightly, but then it'll be capped. And then the city will pick up the rest of that. The issue that ERS has in their funding, one of their issues, is they had POBs that were issued of $500 million of POBs in the early 2000s. And the debt service of those POBs comes out of their city contribution kind of on the front end. So that means less money is going into the fund. That's kind of their fund issue. But they look like the only change they're looking for, it looks like, is to take that cap off and then cap the employee contribution. I have asked the question about what's the structure of the agency underneath. I've not gotten any answers on that.
Just in terms of dialogue, Kelly's posting email and with Jack Ireland, who's the CFO, both of us, and for me quite often, I've been communicating with Mel Atkins, who is the city council person, who's the mayor pro tem and head of this ad hoc committee, and he's been great. I mean, he's term limited, and I think that we all want the same outcome. We're sitting in different places in the stadium, but we're both very interested in the right same outcome. So I view that as real positive, knowing that it's a process that is inherently full of conflicts, and because, you know, we're coming at it from different places. But that part of it has been really good so far. If everyone's okay with kind of what we said, I think there's a general consensus. Would you all be okay with next month staff coming with a specific recommendation on, given what we have communicated to them, we view as the priorities, and then debate that in more detail next month? Is everyone okay with that?
Yes, I'm good.
Okay.
What did we come up with today?
Well, I think that the general consensus is ADC is the first priority, more sooner. Either it's the traditional or something that, you know, quack smells and looks real close to traditional. That the COLA is very important, but it's a secondary priority to the ADC more sooner. And it sounds like there's maybe some healthy debate on, you've mentioned it's distant second. I would probably make it a little bit less distant, but that's all within the zone of the discussion. And then a reduction in the employee contribution downrange would be great, but would be a third priority after those other two. So everyone come forward with kind of that as a group consensus, knowing that there's room and latitude within each of those things, but with those as priorities, that we would task staff to come up with a specific recommendation for next month's meeting.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right. Nothing to vote on, just a will of the board. Okay, great. Great discussion. All input was fantastic, and I really like the art, and I will. I think our actuary, Jeff, and those guys are great, but I really like what Kyron did. I was very impressed with the way they presented things and just the way they looked at it. And I think that the city was also very impressed. The whole argument on the reduction of purchasing power, I mean, that kind of hit my mind and my heart. I mean, because you just really think about people that see a reduction in purchasing power by inflation in the way that it's currently structured, and it really just transcends the numbers on a spreadsheet. You really think about families, and you think about, you know, roll forward 10, 20 years, and we want to do something to help solve that. Also, if you want to take something that's a potential vicious cycle and make it a virtuous cycle of where people have confidence and they feel like their families are protected and taken care of for all the contributions and sacrifices they're
you're making today. So they really, this report really helped make that real to me in a way that I hadn't thought about it before. And so, you know, I've had a little bit more time with it than maybe some of you have, but I really encourage you to continue to read it and also, and once again, Jeff has been great, our existing actuary, very, very high in them as well, and he's done a great job.
One other quick point, as we walk down this process, through this process, something that was mentioned a couple of meetings ago, it probably wouldn't hurt to have some kind of a communicator resource so we can have consistency of the messaging as we go forward once we get specifics down. Just food for thought.
Well, for sure. I mean, I think that you know, if you mean like a reporter,
yeah,
calls or anything like that,
yeah.
I mean, I think you defer to Kelly or me, if anyone contacts you or whatever.
No, I think it goes in the front that we want, just so we have consistency in the message as
yeah,
we go forward.
Okay. You know, up to this point, you know, we've decided or, you know, we've not engaged
yeah,
with anything in that area. And, okay, anything else on this? No wrap of Josh on any of these things we talked about?
No. Nope.
All right. Awesome. Okay. Kelly, your approved ministerial action.
Okay. So the next three items are the standard items that you have on the agenda every month. On page 77 is the list of the activity for the month. It's right in line, the number of refunds, 21, retirement 16, so that was an uptick. But nothing's really unusual. I can tell you next month, we've had just a slew of deaths, so you'll see a lot more deaths. It's actually not that uncommon in winter months to have more deaths, but I think this week alone we have at least, well, just through Tuesday we had 6 in a month, which is a lot. So we've got a lot of that. A lot of rumors going around about lowering the benefits. They can't get 90%, now it's going to be 70%. We've got some people coming in who want to retire because of that. We kind of talk them off the ledge, but everything looks normal there.
Why don't you talk about meeting with the chief the other day?
Okay, so we met, Nick and I met with the chief and one of his lieutenants. We talked a little bit about where the plan funding is, but also the process of this funding situation. And he seemed to appreciate the fact that the activity so far hasn't, he didn't use the word freaked out of staff, but that's what happened in 2016. So he said that the work with the associations seems much calmer than it was in the past, and appreciate that.
Yeah, and he came from a situation in San Jose where they had a pension crisis, and he said there were just a lot of divisive actors, you know, with all sorts of different interests that really muddled things up and created just a lot of negativity. And he just said that he has not seen that here, and sort of just, you know, and he strikes me as an incredibly honest broker who calls balls and strikes well. And so, you know, it's really great to hear that.
Okay, on the next
item,
the contribution report. This is the first report for 2024 with 2024 data. There's nothing unusual on this report. They did, the number of expected employees went up 50 for the year. So they did a bunch of hiring, but we're still 30 under, which actually means they made ground. And there was a rookie class yesterday for fire. And there's one, I think, today maybe, or tomorrow for police. So that's good. They're hiring people. Contributions over 3 pay periods, and everything's on track. So 4 won't kick in anymore. So nothing unusual on this report either. Any questions on the contribution report? The next item is the Board Approval of Trustee Education Travel. Several of you, Michael Teclante, Tina, and Nancy are going to some or all of the TechFirst training and or conference that's coming up in April. I believe Matt may be going as well, but I think he's paying for that on his own, so we don't have him listed here. If anybody else wants to go, let us know.
I'll get one, but I'm not paid.
Okay. Put both of you on there. On Sunday of the conference, there's a business meeting. And in that business meeting, we need to elect delegates to vote. And Sasha, hey, Melissa, can you get Sasha for me?
Yes.
It might be too late to add anybody to delegates, but we have added Michael, Matt, actually Rick Salinas, one of our members who will be there because they had space. Myself, Josh, Brenda, Ryan, is she out there?
No, she's sorry to get her.
Okay. So the business meeting, I'm told this year that there's nothing of substance on the agenda, but the Sunday afternoon, we name the names so people can go, and if you're listed on there, you can go and you can vote. We can give you more information about that. The reason I want Sasha, I want to find out what the deadline is, if she can ask.
You know what time?
3 o'clock, Sunday is up. That
was downtown Dallas, right?
It's down, yeah, in Union
Tower
area. They're doing an eclipse viewing on the 8th.
Yeah.
So we'll add both of you to this. We'll need a motion to do that.
I make the motion.
Okay.
We have a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Motion carries.
Okay, so when Sasha comes in, I can answer. We can ask you. Or it might be too late to add you to the delegate list.
Yeah, you have
to present the evidence in it. So, if it passed the deadline to change it?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Kelly? Drop.
So, under this drop item, we have three pieces of it. Okay, the A is the easy part. A and C are the easy part. So, a few months ago, actually last year, we brought you a de minimis payment, and the board approved paying out this drop payment that was so small that it made sense. We decided at that time not to change the policy. I would just bring each of them back to you because they're pretty rare. It's the only second one that we've had. So right now we have a person that has inherited a drop annuity, and their payment is $5.40 a month to 2038. We would like permission to pay that out in a lump sum. Instead of continuing to track these people and their beneficiaries and that type of thing until 2038.
$1,000.
Yeah.
I don't want to talk about
it. Okay.
So we make a motion.
Okay.
Yeah. First, second, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Okay. All right. The next item is more difficult. John, do you know if the person on the phone number I gave you is on the line?
They're on the line.
Okay.
So if they want to speak, then they can press 5-star.
Okay. So we've got a hardship request. And as you know, we've got the drop policy that lays out how we do hardship requests. Sometimes we can talk about hardship requests in closed session because they're related to medical. This one is not related to medical, so we can't talk about it in closed session. So I'm going to try to talk about it without using names. The person did want to be able to be on the phone. I don't know if they're going to want to speak or if you are all going to have questions for them, but you're free to do that if you'd like. I'm not going to use their name. If they want to use their name, they're welcome to do so. So this situation is a very difficult one, and I'm struggling with the recommendation. I'll just tell you that right up front. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the materials that I included with the agenda, but let me just try to frame the situation here. John, can you just move that item to whatever the discussion sheet on the hardship is? Well, I guess you were there. Never mind. You can go back to where you were. Okay, so this is a person who is not one of our members. This is a person who inherited the drop account from her brother, who was a member, who passed away in 2014. So she doesn't have an ongoing payment. She just has this drop annuity payment. But because of the plan changes we made a couple years ago, they are eligible to ask for a drop hardship. Just a reminder to the board, the way that the policy reads is that the person must demonstrate that a severe financial hardship exists at the time of the application, not one that might come about in the future, that the hardship cannot be relieved through other financial means, such as from insurance or other sources, or liquidating personal assets, unless using those other sources would also cause a financial hardship. And then that the amount requested in the application is reasonably related to the amount necessary for the hardship. So that's what they must demonstrate. And I can tell you this person has been very, very cooperative with us. And we've had a lot of questions, and we've had a lot more questions still, but they've been very great to work with. The board also can only do a hardship for certain circumstances. One of those circumstances is to repair damage to a primary residence not covered by insurance as a result of a natural disaster or significant event, such as a fire or flood. Need to make changes to the primary residence due to medical necessity, pay for funeral expenses, or other similar extraordinary or unforeseeable circumstances arising as a result of events beyond the control of a retiree individual. So this member has submitted two hardship requests. One at this time, I believe she's decided she doesn't want to move forward with, but I'm going to talk about that one because it kind of could impact the other one. So one of the requests relates to is $110,000 to pay for an attorney, and it would cover a retainer and court costs. That's $100,000 plus another $10,000 for a local attorney to try to deal with some legal issues related to property that she owns here in Texas. This property has been in the family for many decades, and it's very, very important to the family. The father put in his will that they couldn't be sold for 50 years, that type of thing. So it's an emotional property for the member. The legal issues relate to a trespass issue of an electric company and some issues, from what I gather, related to a neighbor that's flooding the property. Might be some other issues. So it's attorney costs, basically. $110,000 for that. And then, and I put the legal letter in there so you could see if she would pay the initial amount and then any recovery would be a contingent arrangement after that. The other request is $50,000 to cover costs of the home that she's currently living in, which is in California. And that home has had some damage related to some wind, and it hasn't been repaired, so now it has flooding damage and mold. The issue with that home is the member is going through a divorce currently. And that home is in the husband's name and not in the member's name. California's community property state, I'm not sure if that will end up being an asset or not, that could be considered as an asset that could be sold to help pay for the other piece. That's what I'm talking about. That the $50,000, the initial request that she's asked us that we don't need to consider anymore, included $20,000 for an old HVAC, hasn't been replaced since 1982. The board would not approve that. That's normal wear and tear, and kind of a mold piece and the other repair piece. The insurance claims, there's been multiple insurance claims, and the insurance company awarded that the damage was $11,000. They received a check for $6,500 and then their deductible was $5,100. I thought perhaps an avenue would be to award what she has paid out of pocket for the damages related to the flood and the wind and all that. But there's nothing there. It hasn't been repaired. I don't believe it will be repaired, basically, because of the unknown status of the home. So we're not considering that as a potential outcome.
Does the $11,000 cover the cost of mold remediation?
Actually, no. I mean, no. Not going to cover it. That's, I think, why $20,000 related to the HVAC and another $30,000 related to the mold and the continual flooding and all that. The insurance company said some of those issues are related to wear and tear and settling and not the wind and the flooding that California. So the value of that California home, again, it's not in the member's name. According to Zillow, if you take Zillow minus the mortgage statement that we have, there's about $580,000 in equity. The member thinks that equity number is overstated, and it should be closer to maybe $300,000. And the reason she felt like it was overstated is because she feels Zillow has too high of a price of the home because it hasn't been updated in 1982 and it has some damages. And that the loan, the mortgage might be understated because of the loan modification, which might not reflect the whole loan. I don't know. So somewhere between $580,000 and $300,000 is probably it. Of that, they might get half of that. I don't know. It's difficult to determine the amount of income coming in here because we don't have tax returns. We have very little income or information from the husband. So I'm struggling with this one, as you can tell. We're going all over the place. So I think my recommendation at this point is, although I do know she needs some money to try to save this land, that's very, very important to her. I don't think I can tell you there aren't assets to cover it because I don't know what assets she'll have. I have seen some of those divorce filings, just trying to get part of the husband's pension and spousal support and those types of things. So I can't really make a conclusion or a recommendation to the board. I think until the divorce is final. The last hearing on the divorce was end of January. Her attorneys have told her that she will hopefully have a decision by 90 days, which would be end of April. So I recommend we either deny this because I'm not sure it even fits the criteria or delay it until the divorce.
Question?
This could be a law school exam. What is a financial hardship? And how do you guys view it? Because I always, when I first hear the word financial hardship, I view it as something that's immediate, that has an immediate impact on my ability to take care of my bills. That's how my initial off-the-cuff view of financial hardship is.
Right. So what we do, and it's a very intrusive, painstaking process that we go through, is we ask for 6 months of everything, all their bank statements, all their, if there's any broker statements, their savings accounts. We ask for all their credit card statements, all their bills. We put it all together. We try to, we look at their vehicles. We look at their tax returns. We look at their income. We come up with a net worth statement as well as a cash flow. It's clear to me, very clear to me, that with the income that we have identified that's coming in, and just the credit cards alone, there's a cash flow hardship. Definitely, it looks like to me. I'm not sure we have a clear picture on all the income. That being said, because I don't have a tax return, to me, something's missing because I don't know how it's working. So it looks like there's non-cash flow assets that might be available in cash cash flow is an issue. One of the things, which is actually the item C on here, that I thought might be helpful, but the member is not interested, is members can elect to receive their annuity on an annual basis or a monthly basis. And this member has elected to receive it on an annual basis. And when I'm looking at the cash flow, I'm thinking, wow, wouldn't it be much better to get this money every month? She doesn't want it every month. So to me, that's telling me I'm missing something on the cash flow.
She said why she doesn't want it every month?
No, she didn't. She didn't. I did not understand why.
Is it maybe because of the divorce, maybe?
I don't know.
Reason for us is a decree.
Yeah.
I think she's maybe used to getting the lump sum in January. But in having this conversation, I'm recommending that we change that for other people that might change it. We only have less than maybe 2,000 people that have the annual anyway, but that's another conversation, so that won't help. I just feel like without knowing where the divorce comes out, I have no idea, like on spousal support, pension, who gets the house.
Yeah.
Her intention is to sell that house and move to the Texas property. There's land, that's complicated as well. The Texas property, she would will the house and 2 acres of land, which is valued according to the county record at $163,000. And then there's other land that's around there that she owns with 1/6 of, and her siblings own the other 5/6, and that's about $36,000. But her intention is to sell the house and eventually move to the Texas land.
Okay.
And do what she needs to with the house.
This one does want to speak. The system does want to speak.
Well,
sure. Yep. Anyone objects?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, I was just trying to call Chelsea on the other line, so thank you for allowing me to speak. Let me get back to my notes. First of all, thank you all for kind of hearing about my hardship. And part of the situation, just to go more in details regarding the property there in Texas, my brother, he passed away. He was a fireman, and he passed away at the age of 59. And ironically, he was the only son in my family. I'm sorry, I'm out of breath. I'm running up the stairs now. But in any case, when my dad died in 2017, and since my brother preceded him in passing, there's been an aggressive attempt to basically squeeze us out of our family land. And this is the land that my intent was, after I leave California, my intent was to build back on the land and to make it productive. That was going to be my livelihood, specifically since I'm going through a divorce process. But in any case, I've worked with five different attorneys who have not done anything, or basically pretty much just taken my money and to not do anything. Either they've been paid off, threatened, or whatever. I have no idea. But in any case, the last attorney that I worked with, he did file a claim against Navasota Valley Electric, because basically what they've done, they've installed transformers, electrical wires that crisscross the property, crisscross the home, to where it's not safe to occupy. So he did file a lawsuit on that. The other issue is with the neighboring landowner. He's a businessman out of Houston who basically purchased several acres that used to belong to Tennyson Oil. But in any case, he installed a dam and altered the water flow, and it's causing excessive flooding. So right now we've lost like 15 acres because of the flooding. And now with this pending lawsuit with a counter response to the lawsuit that was filed, they're now trying to claim another 10 acres for adverse possession. So the problem is, the attorney who filed the initial suit with Navasota Valley Electric, after we received their counter response, basically he he quit. So at this point, I am I'm in the middle of a lawsuit without legal representation. And through several different referrals, I was able to reach, well, it's Al Odom and Ben Hall, the third, from Houston. They're very, very successful attorneys. I'm blessed to basically have them even speaking with me. I've not paid them anything, but yet they have researched and provided reports, all of this information, much more than what any of the other attorneys have done that I've retained. So my hope is that that's why I'm requesting the $110,000, because I need it. It's $75,000 for their retainer, plus an additional $25 for, I guess, expenses, and then there was an additional $10,000 for the local attorney who's also on the team. That was the main purpose for that particular hardship. And I know that there are specific criteria to determine what's considered a hardship, but in fact it truly is, because as Kelly mentioned, I am going through a divorce. It's really an awful situation. My employment situation is I have no income, no steady income coming in. I'm an educational consultant at this point, and I do a lot of temporary work because of the, you know, again, just a lot of the details surrounding my marital situation. So at this point, I'm a single mom. My son is in his junior year at Howard. My daughter's getting ready to go to grad school. So basically, my goal, I really am strapped for funding, because I've been living on credit cards. I have no, you know, again, no other income coming in. And I think when I considered, like, you know, with my brother, even though he passed away in 2014, it was very unexpected. And it was during the time when my father was having heart surgery. He was in the hospital in Mansfield having heart surgery, and my brother had gone back to Fairfield to take care of the cat, to feed and do things like that. And when he wasn't there on Monday for my father's surgery, I called a cousin, and that's when they found him deceased in our home. So I say that because I'm very passionate about maintaining this land, because I know that if there was anything that my brother would have wanted me to use this money for, it would definitely be to fight to save that land, because he loved it. It had been in my family for generations and generations. And I know that maybe there's a question on whether or not that's my primary residence, but that's my goal. For the past 3 years, I've been trying to move back, but because of this, because of the issues that I'm having with this neighboring landowner, with the flooding, our drive has been washed away 3 times. I've had to continue to replace the piping. It's just one thing after another, and I've worked with various, like local, state, even any federal agencies that can come and do reporting. I've worked with Texas Environmental Quality Assurance, USDA, all of those. And they basically, you know, I have the reports showing the issues, but unless I have the right legal representation, it means nothing, because I'm unable to utilize the property as intended. So I don't know if that answers your questions, but it truly is emotional, because you know, again, I see what's happening, but I just don't, I have not had the resources to basically to fight it.
Ma'am, thank you. This is Nick Merrick. I'm the chairman, and thank you. That was a very clear understanding. I clearly see there's a lot of emotion, a lot of, you know, family legacy issues involved. We can all empathize with that. We'll deliberate on this, but thank you very much. That was very clear and concise and much appreciated.
Thank you.
Okay. Kelly's recommendation, staff's recommendation, is to wait until you get the divorce decree or deny it.
I'll make a motion.
Yeah.
No, second.
Two.
Well,
what's the motion?
To wait till after.
To wait, yeah.
Hello? Hello? Okay, I'm sorry. May I add something to that? As far as the timing, that's part of the issue, because, again, as I mentioned, these attorneys, they've been researching. They're hanging on by a thread with helping me, because with the former attorney, there was a court date that was set in February, and I had to, I actually reached out to the other counsel and told him that I'm trying to find another attorney. He postponed it until March 10th. So they were supposed to go for discovery on March 10th, and then even Al Odom and Ben Hall, they reached out to the other counsel and said that, you know, we're still in the process of trying to solidify the contract to get things in place. So it is a timing issue. Unfortunately, with the divorce, even with the divorce, most likely I will not have a response back from that until after, like, late April. And, again, these guys are holding on by a thread, and I'm at a point where they've continued to stall and to have postponement within the court. So a decision needs to be made as soon as possible. And I will also say, even with the divorce proceedings, with the value of the home, and here's kind of the dilemma also. Even with the equity that's in the home, most likely the home will have to be sold and we will divide it. Again, with all of the repairs, with the condition of the property, I basically see being able to generate maybe $150,000 from that. And even if I'm providing that $150,000 to pay these attorneys, I will have nothing to even build on or to live in. I will have no home because all of the money would be going to protect the property. So I guess I'm just appealing to you guys to see if you can make a decision much sooner, if possible, so that I can tell these guys whether or not, you know, I'll be able to work with them or not. But it would be really unfortunate because when you think of a hardship and when you think of the severity of what's normally approved, this, to me, I mean, it's very severe. It truly is life or death.
Ma'am, once again, thank you. I think that we would like Kelly to speak to the attorney to just validate some of the things that you're saying. I think the best we can do right now is that I think that trustees are prepared to make a motion to defer it until Kelly can advance the ball a little bit, talk to your attorney, perhaps get the final divorce decree. But I think that's the best we can do today. Thank you for, like I said, being clear, making your case well, and we need to move on. But and you know, we allowed you to speak, which is atypical, but we did that to show respect and because we do see that you're stating something of significance, and we want to try to get to the appropriate answer. So we're going to have to move on. Thank you. And I think there's a motion, and appreciate your comments, but let's go ahead and proceed. We're going to proceed now with the trustee's action. Would someone like to make
a motion? We made a motion in a second.
Okay. Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Hold on. Wait. I'm sorry. This is Nancy. What was the motion?
The motion is to wait till she gets the divorce finalized, and then we can reassess. The determination of whether to grant or not.
And also, recommendation. Yeah, and also task Kelly was speaking to the attorney to validate some of the things that the lady is communicating to us.
And hopefully in that conversation, your attorneys will understand we really are in this process and maybe they'll hold on a little longer.
Yeah. Kelly, the attorney she has, I live in Houston. They're amazing attorneys. Okay. I know them. They're amazing.
Good. That's great. Okay, we're going to move on. Ma'am, thank you very much for your comments and thoughts. Okay.
The last item that I have on this is item B, and then we're behind, so we'll move quickly. But this is in this conversation, we realized that it might be, and we've actually had other requests, that we should allow people that have elected annuals to have a one time option to now go monthly. So on page 87 of the policy, in 5B, any drop annuitant who is receiving an annual drop annuity will have a one-time opportunity to convert that to a monthly drop annuity, and then we'll do the actuarial math to make sure the end result works out. So if you're agreeable to that, we would need a motion.
Do you have a motion? Okay, second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
The motion carries.
Thank you.
All right, Ryan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, I'll move this relatively quickly because the kids put together some additional educational slides I asked them to do. I'll cover the 2023 Q4 performance report when we ended the year with a 10.3% return for the overall DPSC portfolio and up to 16.7% for the public.
Ryan, I think we might be losing the form. How many trustees are on the phone?
You have three on the phone.
Three trustees?
Yeah.
You're not counting Ken, right?
Nope.
Okay, three, six, fine. Okay,
16.7% for the public portfolio, which is about three quarters of the portfolio now. Moving into 2024 returns, we're up 2.3% for the overall portfolio and up 3.3% for the public ex-cap portion of the portfolio. On liquidation of the private market assets, distributions have been slow year to date with only $2.2 million coming back. We have a few sales within the real estate portfolio and possible sales of private equity we'll talk about later that would result in material money coming back in the next few months. On the custodian search, we had an on-site meeting. We engaged Calum's operational team to help us with the RFP and the search. On the custodian side, they had an on-site, two-day on-site here towards the end of February. They're kind of in discussion with our current custodian, JP Morgan, data gathering and putting together an RFP that we'll review and they hope to issue by early April. Just highlight there, after the on-site meeting, if we do make a change in the custodian, it's likely it's a kind of a long-term project where the new custodian would be up and running with the prior custodian, so it's probably a 2025 mid-year switch over if we end up making a change there. Investment initiatives, we're kind of just getting started on the asset allocation study. Aaron and Colin some slides on how they're coming up with their capital market assumptions, but we have an IAC meeting in 2 weeks where we, in January, we talked to IAC about initial ideas and the process. We plan to come back to the investment committee in a couple of weeks with a few options to look at, and then from there, based on their feedback, we bring some to the board sometime in Q2 to review and approve. AW is coming in at the April meeting to review the real estate portfolio. And then kind of once we get through asset allocation, I think we need to have a conversation on all board on the private market side and kind of get started there with some investment policy updates, paving plan, and that kind of thing. Let's give a few of these market charts. So this is looking at the return on our public market portfolio. So there's a lot of green on the page, which we'd like to see. A few things to note here. Eastern Shore, the U.S. small cap manager struggled with the last, since we hired them, is doing pretty well so far this year, outperforming up 5.2 compared to benchmark 1.5 year to date, only 2 months. And then WCM, the new active global X growth manager, not the ball cover right out of the gate, up 10.6% compared to benchmark 7.3. We ended the month with $1.965 billion in AUM. Investment gain so far year to date of $44 million and $22 million of net outflows. Added this every month, but since 2018, we just dropped below 100, but once we see sales back, we'll be back above. But private assets, net inflows have covered just about 100% of net outflows. We talked about that dynamic changing as we get some of these legacy private assets back and we start redeploying to new private investments. On the safety reserve, we ended the month at $158 million in cash and short-term core bonds compared to the target of $177. The net output decreased a little bit this year compared to last year. We're running at $8.6 million per month. That gives us coverage in that portfolio through August of 2025. So no issues on cash. We're good with our 40 $3 million we have through end of June. On asset allocation, we're a little bit overweight to some of the equity managers, just slightly, so that a possible action we might look at in a few months to get those back down to their individual targets. With that, if there's no questions on the portfolio, I'll hand it over to Makita to go to their material. All right.
Thanks, Ryan. So we have, four items today. They should go relatively quick, and there's nothing that requires a decision on behalf of the board today. So just providing updates and sharing information. So I'm going to cover the first two items, and then Colin will cover the second two. So asset allocation. Ryan mentioned we started the process with the IC back in January. So I'm going to give a little update on how the modeling works at a very high level. So,
hey, Aaron, would you mention one other thing? Would you just sort of comment on the IAC relative to other comparable firms you work with in terms of engagement, breadth, and depth, and just sort of make some color commentary on that?
Up here versus everyone else. I mean, it's a very well-seasoned group, makes thoughtful decisions, knows when to get in the weeds and when to keep it high level. So it's working very well. We're at good cadence, and it's, you know, I hate the phrase best practice, but I mean, they're setting best practices in my mind.
Okay, and you're comparing that to how many others that you kind of had either directly or indirectly come in contact with?
Yeah, like 15 other plans around the country.
Okay, it would be comparable to ours.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, in like, you know, more than half are in that $1 to $5 billion range.
Got it.
Okay. Thank you. You know, you're punching above your weight relative to the size of the plan. So, you know, some of these slides were shared with the IC previously, and some of these concepts are kind of very routine to people in the investment industry, and maybe not to, you know, people outside the investment industry. But the asset allocation framework is always based on this concept called mean variance optimization. So what that means is we as a consulting firm and all the other consulting firms and a lot of the big banks and asset managers come up with our predictions of what we think every asset class's future return will be, what its future volatility will be in any given year, and how it correlates or moves or doesn't move relative to the other assets. And, you know, this process, mean variance optimization, is widely used, but it isn't perfect. So the phrase garbage in, garbage out is kind of the criticism that some will give to it. You know, if the inputs or your estimates aren't good, the outputs don't matter. So the whole point of the next 5 minutes is to just show you kind of how we come up with our inputs and why we have confidence in them and what's happening in the market that gives us confidence as investors going forward. So we list kind of the main things for each big bucket asset class: income, growth, valuation. I'm going to not even go into these needs. But the biggest thing driving the development of a lot of these assumptions and the development of what we think future returns is the bond market and the yield curve. So the blue line, where the yield curve was, you know, two years ago, at the end of 2021. You saw what happened with Federal Reserve and the market. So the last 2 years, the green line and the pink line. So we have a much different world today with a higher elevated yield curve. This is really important because yields drive returns. For bonds, 100%, and then bonds
and where they are in the rate environment has a big influence on other asset classes. So if you look at this chart, the blue line is basically the yield for investment-grade bonds in the given year. And you'll notice the chart ends in 2014. That's because overlaid on that is the green line, which is the return you would have earned if you bought investment-grade bonds, the 10-year future return in any given year. So if you look at, say, 1990, the yield was in the 8-ish percent. If you held those bonds for 10 years, you would have earned around 8%. And you follow that line, I mean, those lines are basically right on top of each other. And we've talked about, you know, everyone talked about the 40-year environment of yields declining. So for many, many years, that meant every time we did an asset study at the beginning of the year, all the predictions were kind of trending lower and lower. That's why every pension plan around the country, every public pension plan, was lowering and lowering their actuarial target return because it was becoming harder and harder to hit 8% because the yield curve was declining. We have what we're calling an inflection point. Because of what happened in the last 2 years, the yield curve has raised, you can get 4-5% owning an investment-grade bond, treasury, when you couldn't get that before, when you were getting maybe like 1-2%. So this chart we've used for many years, and I found it hardly confusing until it was finally explained well. But if you look, the green bar is the bond expected return in each one of those years. You can see how it goes down, 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 and then we're picking back up now. The blue is the equity expected return, and then in each year, and that one's going down. And then the pink is the 60-40 expected return. So each year was getting harder and harder. But because of what's occurred with the yield curve and how that interplays into all the other asset classes, you actually have an uptick now. So our models and what we see from competitors are actually showing that earning your actuarial target going forward now appears a lot more realistic than it was 2 years ago. So what we're going to do next is we're working with staff. We've already come up with we're evaluating possible tweaks to your target asset allocation and if we need to make them or not. We're going to stress test it a little more and debate this with the IEC in a couple weeks.
Okay, so just to kind of put a little color to this, that this is 60-40 equity bonds. You're just buying the index.
Yeah.
If you're long this, and you're saying that if you're long just the index at 60-40, you have a 56% chance of exceeding 7%.
Yes.
What would be reasonable when we're really talking about, you know, just little digits of confidence to say that with a more optimal asset allocation and with hopefully using your menu of manager choices and picking high-performing managers, how much more can you grind that 56% north, do you think?
Yeah, it's not like nothing the 80, but you can get it over 60%. And you think about a normal distribution.
Mm-hmm.
When we model things, if our models say you're going to earn 7%, that puts you at the top of the normal distribution. And so 50% of the time you can either be above that, 50% below. So to earn more, you maybe move a little to the right with manager selection. You also increase your percentage of kind of beating your target return by having a mix that models more than, you know, I know you, so for example, you're at what, 6.5?
Yeah.
So just, you know, that means your probability of achieving that, the 60-40 could be over 60 on its own. And then add in the fact that your portfolio is, quote, better optimized than the naive 60-40, it gets you, you know, higher.
Okay. And then, because it's 2024, this moved up or down, or what do you think?
So we have published the 2024 one, and this is a sample generic portfolio, and you can see the big jump occurred in 2023 and just a tiny dip now. So basically, any of the models we showed you last year are going to be very applicable this year.
Okay.
So not a material change. The yield curve ended the year like almost exactly where it started. Equities are more expensive, but there are some other elements that go into more than just value.
Okay. And then one final thought on this, that versus 60-40, which is under the index, to the portfolios that pure firms have, they would typically have what percent privates?
$2 billion pension plan would have right now 25%.
Okay. And if you were to take that amount out of the denominator or the numerator or have it in, how much of a difference in return would you say on average that is right now?
The impact of privates?
Yes.
We're talking maybe 20, 30 basis points of, you know, instead of modeling 7, maybe model 7.3.
Got it. Okay. Okay. Yeah, we're just trying to get a sense of proportionality on this as we think about our portfolio with, you know, things that we're still dealing with, you know, with an allocation, a target of 15% in the future, winding down, perhaps, you know, reinitiating, replacing things that haven't performed expectations, which things will exceed expectations. So I think it's helpful to have these numbers kind of proportionalized in your mind. So thank you very much.
The big push into alternatives, in my opinion, in the last 10, 15 years, was because it was becoming harder to get because of what was happening to that orange line. And so the analogy I use with, hopefully there's at least a couple of golfers out here, but now, you know, before you had to get the driver off the tee, part of the hole. Now you can hit an iron, and you're still in play, and still have just as equal odds to get there. You can, and most plans are, continue to hit the driver and continue to invest in private markets, because then they're going to try to take advantage, try to birdie the hole.
Got it.
I see one head shaking. These guys go.
What if you can't? What if you can't hit it well with iron? Is that okay?
You use a driver.
Well, and the can't hit it well. Well,
use a driver.
Yeah, I guess then. But I mean, that's right. Push the analogy further, the driver naturally is like private markets. The really good shot is really good, and the really bad is really bad. And that's the dispersion of returns in private markets. So we saw here what can happen if you're on the bottom of that dispersion of manager selection.
Yeah, but it's just one scorecard at the end of the day, so we take that very seriously. Okay.
One more quick question. Do you see the complexion of privates changing as we go forward? So instead of the old conventional private equity infrastructure, real estate, now you're incorporating opportunistic credit, which can do control and non-control deals, as well as private. You're also seeing more asset allocators move from the old 60-40 to that 30-30-40. What were your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, private debt has been talked about ad nauseum in the last few years, and it's something we're looking at in your portfolio if it makes sense. Private equity returns will be, you know, private equity use. Company buys a private company, puts a bunch of leverage, and sells it. Well, now that leverage costs a lot more money. So there are natural changes occurring. You talk to private market managers, they're still quite bullish. But the asset class has become more efficient as more players are there. So potentially the spreads or the degrees of separation kind of tighten up and, you know, becomes more of a beta flight than a true alpha flight. Great. I have two. We've had this cadence now where every quarter or so we'll do a deeper dive into a certain subset of your public markets managers. So we did fixed income, we did global equity managers, and this is the others. So the small cap and then not in the emerging markets.
Are all of our managers on your list of ones you diligence and review and recommend?
They are, and the short answer is yes. We have this concept of the bullpen.
Yeah.
The bullpen basically just means it's been fully vetted and could go into anyone's portfolio tomorrow if there was a hit-by-bust scenario. There's plenty of others that we do recommend and have been fully vetted that don't fit in the bullpen, maybe because they're a little too focused or not appropriate for every plan.
Okay, but in terms of a diligence screening filter, every one of our managers get up the best of Makita in terms of a review and a filter and an ongoing sort of evaluation.
Yes, so actually we have last year's and I have the new ones for this year coming up, but we have these summaries which we share with staff that shows and there's a rating and they all fit into the approved scores. There's no legacy ones that are like, they're all well vetted, yes.
Okay. So contrast that, the concept of the bullpen, with if someone said, all I want are the absolute best of the best performing managers, and that's the mandate. How do you reconcile the realities of implementing an asset allocation with that concept that I only want to see and know them if they're the absolute top, upper quartile, whatever, decile?
Well, you fall into the trap of chasing returns, and you don't, you hire whoever's done the best during the last 10 years doesn't mean you're going to earn the best the next 10 years.
Because every manager has nothing to do with it.
We don't want to chase returns.
Yeah,
so I wouldn't want you to have a portfolio of the ones that are the best performers looking backwards. I want you to have a portfolio of the ones with the most confidence in going forward that they will deliver.
Okay. In your view, is that what we have in our stable today is a good representation of the best of what Makita has to offer or amongst
I mean, there's always some that are getting a closer in the warning signs at times.
Mm-hmm.
We monitor that, and there's one on your fixed income that we're evaluating right now. But it's not as scientific as, like, you know, there's an element of art to it as well. So someone like Global Alpha and Eastern Shore both started kind of poorly, which is what we get to. But we still have confidence in them and that they can outperform going forward. And that's what we want. We don't want to be trigger happy and overly trading the portfolio.
And you've never found that staff isn't receptive to, you know, someone who's not performing or they're saying, hey, this is just one we want to keep regardless. So you found staff to be open to looking at everything and
if anything, more the opposite.
Yeah.
Bringing to us to say, hey guys, like, we need your updated thoughts on XYZ manager because we're unhappy with the way they're performing.
Okay.
And I know that they're meeting with the managers very frequently, more so than most clients that work with.
But you look for sound drift and changes in the leadership as well, so.
Yeah, so I mean, that's all part of the monitoring process. And style drift and style out of favor is kind of what the reason, so I'm going to get into two of these managers. Let's just dive in.
Okay.
So you got these are, we have the pink and the yellow here. Small cap managers, and one is U.S., one is non-U.S., and the yellow is emerging markets. And these are what we call filling the gap, because The green managers, your global equity managers, we did a lot of evaluation when we came on board here and, you know, found that they are generally not investing in the smallest companies and not investing in the emerging markets. So to kind of have the full picture of the investable equity universe, we as a group have decided to have these allocations. So they're filling those gaps and seeking outsized returns in those places. You have about $60 million in each of the small caps and $90 million in the emerging market manager, and that's right on target. So how have they done? So you've only had Eastern Shore and Global Alpha for a little while, you know, like 2.5 years and almost 2 years. And you do see some red there. It didn't start that well. So we have a lot of words. Ryan actually showed that. They're actually both outperforming now, like you had in the last few months. So the smoking gun is we still believe in these firms and these strategies, and we think that they will outperform going forward. You have certain short periods where any manager may not outperform. And so like the issue with Eastern Shore, they focus on quote quality companies. And what they define that is basically companies that are profitable and have low debt. So over time, that makes a lot of sense. Those companies will outperform. We had an environment in the fourth quarter last year when everything went through the roof. Many unprofitable companies went shot straight up. This was when it appeared that there was going to stop raising rates, et cetera. So certain strategies that have this quality bias will not deliver those crazy returns when it's a speculative growth environment. But we still believe in Eastern Shore and think that they will be the outperformer for it. Another example is the other one, Global Alpha. So I met with Global Alpha last week in Florida, two of the PMs. This is the small cap non-US. They, for the asset class, they're kind of concentrated. It's only about 60 positions. And this chart, pictures worth more than all our words. The blue is what they believe is going to come from stock selection. So not from picking the right sectors, not from picking the right countries, just finding the right company. And so when you have a strategy that's solely really based on stock selection and it's concentrated, a few winners and your numbers look great, just a few bad quarters from any couple of stocks could pull you down. And so they were very optimistic going forward and a little defensive about the results of the past few years, but we still believe that, you know, it's all the same people, same process, that over time it will work.
So the bold bullet there struck me in terms of your highlighting the stock selection, you know, and performing. I mean, isn't that what they should be good at? I mean, isn't that what?
Yeah. So
it kind of just seems a little ironic to me.
Yeah, I mean, right, like paying them to pick stocks. And
if they're not good at selection, are they the right manager?
I would just say one quarter or two quarters is a very short time period when investing with an active public markets manager. And kind of, I don't want to go again with the golf analogy, but 18 holes is a long journey. Anyone can par 31 hole. But over time, the better golfer will produce a better score. And that's the idea. So we think, you know, these firms are better firms, and anyone can kind of strike lightning in a quarter or two, but they will kind of compound and their selections will produce better results long term. But your point is totally spot on. Stock selection, that's what they're supposed to do.
And, I mean, part of that was their quality focus, and we're comparing them to a core benchmark, so I don't know how much of it that explains it.
Yeah,
that's part of it. And we have that kind of quality bias across quite a few of our athletes.
So
they were being compared against another benchmark?
No, the benchmark's a core benchmark. They have a slight growth in quality tilt, so they're kind of like a slight growth quality benchmark. It's an appropriate benchmark, but we should be talking to them of stylistic differences between each manager and how they expect them to perform.
And so, you know, I don't want to just use all their stuff, but this is the last 14 calendar years, and this is their outperformance each year. So you see, last year just so happened to be their worst year. So that sometimes you have just bad timing as well. But we do believe, to your point, Nick, that they are a top-tier strategy. This isn't a, you know, quote, mistake manager like some of the legacy stuff that was inherited on the private. It's just in a given period, sometimes what their approach is doesn't excel in every single kind of environment.
We've talked about it internally, but after the portfolio manager change or organizational change or style shift, if we can't stick with the manager for at least 3 to 5 years, we shouldn't be hiring a new manager. So we can be veteran periods of underperformance.
Yeah. So with time, you get something like, here, this is RBC, your emerging markets manager. And this has gone through some stretches of underperformance. But if you look just the colors on the top line, you've had them for over 5 years. You know, green almost every environment. You know, 1 year is just noise. So this strategy, they take a top-down and bottom-up. They start with kind of big themes in the emerging markets world, and then they try to find the best companies that fit those themes. The companies, again, with this quality bias, but again, that just means basically less speculative companies that should be more stable, and they produced a ton of their outperformance in 2022. The markets were down a lot, owning better companies, they didn't go down. So, and they've been good with their country selection. They avoided China to some extent relative to kind of market weight, and they've been better in India, which has been a good trade. But so you see, kind of sticking with them, you know, they haven't outperformed every period. Next, get the numbers. You see the chart on the top left. Basically, the blue ones are the quarters they've done well. The green ones are the ones they underperform. And the pink is the cumulative over and underperformance. So you see there are strong periods when they can be outperforming, then it'll dip. But by sticking with a good manager, it will compound over time. So there's no action today. This is just, you know, a lot of this work happens behind the scenes. Brian still does the thunder when he does his updates, so we're sharing kind of what's going on and what debates and discussions do happen at the IC.
Great, thank you.
Okay. Real quickly, I guess Helen will give you the highlights of your 2023 results.
Absolutely. Yeah. And on this one, I really like to frame a question. Okay. We've talked for the last 15, 20 minutes. You've talked about the IAC. You've talked about your grouping of managers. You've talked about, you know, positives about what we've done. How do you rationalize those comments with multiple pink boxes of underperformance? And so when you, Colin, when you frame this, I'd like you to comment, I'd like for someone who's listening to be able to reconcile everything you said in the last 20 minutes with this chart.
Sure.
You start it up and I'll have it necessary.
Yeah, sounds good. So this just looks at, just a reminder, this looks at 2023 through December 2023. So obviously Brian and Aaron gave some more recent updates. But it's always a great time to pause at the end of the year and just look back on the trailing year and see what worked and what didn't. So that's sort of the time period we're looking at here. This is a good executive summary that just points out, slices and dices some of the data and points out some key figures. At the top line there, you can see the total system produced a 10.3% return, so that's positive. Markets were positive mostly across the board in 2023, and so we're seeing that on an absolute level. That being said, Nick pointed out those pink boxes in the middle there. There has been some underperformance versus both the policy benchmark as well as peers. And so you can see the fund return 10.3%, and that's compared to the policy benchmark, which returned 15.7% over the same period. So that's about 5% underperformance. If you look at peers, it's the same story. It underperformed. It was a little bit closer, but it underperformed as well, 10.3 versus 11.7. So when you take the fund collectively, there was underperformance during a positive year.
But if you jump down a little bit, I would rationalize it with the public markets versus peers as well as the 60-40. The public market portfolio, those managers that we do monitor consistently, we have conviction, and those have done well and have worked in during this year. So you can see the total public market portfolio added 16.3% versus the 60-40 benchmark of 15.1%. And then if you take that same return and compare it to peers, it also outperforms. So I would say the public market portfolio, the one that we have most control over and the one that we are vetting and has our best ideas, is working, and it did work in 2023. Aaron, do you want to add anything?
So to beat the dead horse, three of the four pink boxes are directly the result of that kind of anchor around the system from the past. So you have those bad assets weighing down the second line, your total performance. You have those bad assets weighing down the third line. And the fourth line, underweight global equity and overweight real estate. Well, we know we can't get to our target equity if we can't sell the real estate. So it's the story repeats. The board is doing a great job. Staff's doing a great job with the levers that can be pulled and can be pushed. But the stuff that is just the immovable objects are a slower process, and it will continue to kind of have its, sense and stink on the total picture.
Yeah. How much is real estate dragging me?
So in the year, it was like a percentage, I guess you could argue. Ironically, the see the blue bar to the left. And then look at that big green bar to the left, private equity. So that's the effect that your strategies didn't live up to kind of the private equity benchmark.
And just a reminder, private markets are on a quarter lag. So, this private equity is largely the hub energy right now that we took at the end of 2022.
Great. Now go ahead and move on unless there's any more questions on the topic. The next page I wanted to touch on was this quarterly manager scorecard. And this just breaks out all the public active managers and compares them to their benchmark and looks at yes and no, did it underperform or overperform during the period. So you can see over the 1 year period ending in December, there's a lot of red no's. So I think only four out of the 11 managers here outperformed. At the top, you can see the equity managers, and we'll mention that 2023 was a very narrow market for equities, as I'm sure you're aware and have heard of the Magnificent Seven, the big tech stocks really drove markets globally. Through November, the market did broaden out a little bit in December, but through November, 50%, over 50% of the returns for the MSCI active benchmark were driven by those seven stocks. So that created, made it a little bit more difficult for active managers to outperform over the 1 year period when they're comparing against a benchmark that's market weighted with these huge tech companies. So that's part of the reason we're seeing some underperformance there. At the top one, I mentioned Boston Partners, the value managers, so they're going to be underweight those types of names, as well as they're underweight the US, which really drove market. So that sort of explains a little bit of the variance here for those equity funds. But if you look further down, the fixed income fund at the very bottom of the page there look a lot better. That portfolio has really worked. Almost all of them have outperformed over the 1 year period and over trailing year period. And so we're very happy with where that stands. And then just generally over the 3 and 5 year periods, you're seeing a lot more green outperformance. And so it seems the active management has been working a lot stronger over the longer term.
At some future point, it'd be helpful, I guess, to perspective on this.
So,
that's what we're focused on.
Yeah. So we did a call. Ryan's team, our team, and our, how many went out? 3 or 4 of our fixed income researchers a week or two ago to discuss that.
Sure.
But, yeah, that'll be an IEC item in the next couple meetings.
Yeah, we want to kind of get through asset allocation and figure out what we're doing with that credit bucket and then go into that portfolio.
And
another thing I've mentioned on this page in the past, but if you look at that fifth column, the third, the last column, 5 year, just how many say NA? So basically, you revamped the whole portfolio. The ones that have made it to 5 years, you see one, two, three, four, five that are outperforming and one that's not. In active management, like if you're hitting 60% correct, it's going to compound very well. So you have, you know, five out of six are outperforming. So that's a great track record.
Absolutely. I'll go ahead and jump another page, and this is a topic that we've looked at in the past, but this just breaks down the equity portfolio and looks at it from a regional perspective. So that's looking at the U.S., U.S. exposure, developed non-U.S. and emerging markets. I'll just focus on that sort of gray line at the bottom there. That just looks at the total public equity bucket versus the benchmark. And so the total equity bucket is slightly underweight, about 10% underweight to the U.S. And subsequently overweight to not developed non-U.S. And that has served to be a little bit of a headwind during 2023 when the markets were driven by U.S. Investment. So you'll see that when we compare the total global equity to the benchmark, there was some slight underperformance, and part of that has to do with where it's regionally allocated. I'll jump up a few more slides. We already sort of touched on this page, but it just gives that attribution of where the underperformance came from. The vast majority of it came from selection within private equity. You can see that there. Also being underweight global equity during time when global equity markets were on tear. On a relative basis. And so those are, I would say, two of the biggest drivers of underperformance for the past year. We'll jump to this page, which shows the fund at an asset class level. The top line, obviously, there was some underperformance over the quarter to date and year to date period, which I already talked about. Further down, you can see global equity added 20.9% during the year, so strong double digit returns. That's slightly trail the benchmark, as I mentioned, largely due to the exposure within U.S. and tech names. Further down the page, you can see sort of in the middle, there's all the fixed income asset classes. All of those, you can see strong returns across the board. We're getting 5% on cash and equivalents, 5% on short-term core bonds for the year, and then even higher returns down the spectrum as we look through those. The only one that did lag was high yield bonds. Every other active manager within this bucket outperformed. Obviously, high yield bonds is one we're going to continue to look at. I'll go ahead and Aaron already touched on some specific managers, so I don't want to get into any more specifics unless there's questions. I'll just go ahead and jump to the end here. And this just shows the positioning of the portfolio at the end of the year. Obviously, slightly underweight to public equity. And fixed income and cash, and then the overweights to private equity and real assets, as you all know. That wraps up my comments on this report. Happy to take any questions at this time, or we can move on. Excellent. I will jump to the last part of our agenda very quickly, and it's just a review of our private market report as of September 30th. So obviously, private market reporting is on about a quarter lag, so we're looking at data through the end of September. The main story here is there's not much change. We put together an executive summary that looks at quarter-to-quarter change at the total fund level, or at the total program level, I'd rather say. And so you can see here that about $1 million was distributed, and there was a $9 million adjustment in NAV, which led to about a 1.5% decrease for the quarter. So largely flat. The short story is there's largely no change with minimal change with the private markets program. On an individual asset class level, private equity was largely flat, no major adjustments in NAV. Just a reminder that the third quarter was a negative quarter for public equity equivalents, and so that sort of makes sense that there would be not much change here. Real estate was down about 1.2% for the quarter with no major distributions. Infrastructure was up slightly based on NAV adjustments for the third quarter, about 5%. And agriculture was down about 10% for the quarter. The agriculture fund has been your strongest performing private asset over the long run. And then finally, timber was largely flat for the quarter as well. So as I said, slightly negative, but not a ton of change for the third quarter. private assets continue to come back. I think Ryan mentioned it was about $65 million that came back in 2023. So that hopefully that continues. The rest of the pages here give a breakdown of individual buckets within private markets and then individual funds. I don't plan to touch on any of them specifically unless there's questions. Happy to take those now, Dave, and wrap up.
Well, I think the main, a couple points. Is there any investment in the private equity portfolio that is something that is either directly or an affiliate of something you recommend in your bullpen?
No.
Okay. And so essentially your oversight over that is very different than what it is over the public portfolio because it really is not, they're not groups or firms you would evaluate. Is that fair to say?
The only one we likely have met with on a possible investment perspective is Industry Ventures.
Yeah.
So your most recent and best performing, but no, we're not investing in any of the others.
Got it.
So some of them are not really active.
Yeah. Have you ever seen another plan that sort of transformed itself from two-thirds private to one-third public to the flip in 6 or 7 years like we have?
Yeah, I worked on one directly, the one I've shared a few times in Louisiana.
Yeah.
So this chart, like, you know, it's even more extreme. Their approach was a little different. Some of their assets were just the auditors wrote them down to zero.
Mm-hmm.
Others they sold at fire sales. So that, and they did have a good chunk in hedge funds that were slow, but you got your money back in a couple of years as opposed to 8 years.
Yeah.
It took a while. Like once it was clean, then the portfolio had to have multiple years of being a healthy portfolio to see the fruits of the labor hit the 3 year number, the 5 year number. It has now. It's been, with what I would call it a clean 5 year track record, but the other 5 years of transition were challenging.
Yeah. Brian, what would you say if you had to allocate your time between what you spend, you and your team spend on privates versus public? What would you say that allocation of time is? Yeah.
It's getting closer to 50-50, you know, 18, 19, 20, 21, it was, you know, 80-20 on the private market side of it. And then of that 80%, a lot of that I was very focused on a few of the ones that we had to get our hands dirty on.
Well, just, you know, kind of speaking for the board, just so there's complete clarity between us and, you know, Nikita, there's only one scorecard. You know, I would use a bowling analogy versus golf, but I guess if you're a golfer and you know, some of us don't do that stuff. And there's only one scorecard, and the scorecard is the combined one. It is appropriate to acknowledge the fundamental different nature of the assets. You know, the chart that when I look at the privates, I really look at that chart in terms of the NAV at the end of 2016, 2017, I think the $1.5 billion. And then we generated, you know, one or so of liquidity out of that, and it completely covered our shortfall. You know, to me, that has been a salvage operation. But it was better to undertake that and not have to fund the shortfall by selling, you know, public securities. But there's only one scorecard, and we acknowledge that. But when the nature of the assets are fundamentally different, you have to treat them different, and you have to, you know, work with them differently. So that's kind of how we have thought about it, you know, as a board. And, you know, but it is one scorecard, and if you ever see us thinking or acting differently, we need you to call us out on that, okay? Even though you do, I think you did a great job acknowledging how you think about them differently and so on. And also, you know, we appreciate your guys' role as we continue to transform this into something that looks more traditional. You know, traditional is a big word. We want the traditional ADC, we want the traditional asset allocation, we want want the traditional results. So
yeah.
We're going to move away from some of these other things. But all that, you know, that's where we're headed, and that's the consensus of the trustees. And if you see anything different from that, you know, we expect you to speak up. So.
Yeah. While we're opening up here, I think the portfolio is in the whole system is in much better shape today than it was 5 years ago. You have exited a lot of troubling assets and paid a lot of benefits of that. You have a clear path forward in terms of on the investing side, and a lot of good work is happening on the funding side. So I think everyone is doing you guys are handed a very challenging deck of cards, and the progress is incremental, but I think you're closer to the end than the bottom in terms of where you're at. I see there's a path forward.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, but it is us. It isn't what we inherited versus, we inherited a great city with a lot of economic prosperity, too. So, there's other cities in the country that don't have that.
Yeah.
So, if you inherit things that some are positive, some are negative. I agree. I've used the concept that when we look at the IRR returns, because that's traditionally what the metric is, when you look at the privates, you look at the IRRs are essentially non-existent. And I view that as time theft. And it's one of the worst types of theft there can be is time theft. And we see the impact of time theft on the degradation of buying power with a little bit of inflation when we're looking at COLA. And you see it here where there was so much money tied up in private assets that did not compound at a rate of return and were a drag on everything. But once again, it's part of the overall portfolio and we own it. So.
Yeah.
Anything else from anyone on this? Once again, we appreciate you guys as very, very good business partners. We appreciate all that you do.
Thank you.
Kelly, do you want to go ahead and knock out the rest of the stuff and then go back and then close the closed session?
Yes, my
turn.
Okay. Nothing to say. You're empty
for monitors. We're going to brief menu D, Kelly's report.
Your Antiquers Monitor is available for you. Open records request, we had 3 since the last meeting. 2 were from a member, they're closed out. One of them went back to plan changes from 1968. That took a long time to put together, but those are done.
Okay. Going back to items 8 and 9, Lone Star and legal issues, is all that in closed session, Josh?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to go into closed session now.